morning. Good morning, Santa Fe. Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at KSFR.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at Facebook.com/Radio Cafe. And this is day four on the Radio Cafe of the KSFR semi-annual fun drive, the fall fun drive. And I'd like to welcome the great writer, Michael McGarrity. He is with us this morning. Welcome.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to see you again.
Thank you so much. So we're asking people to go to their phones and make a call to support KSFR. The number is 505-428-1393, 428-1393. And to support what I think is a terrific public radio station based here in Santa Fe and extending now far beyond, thanks to our expanded signal. Michael McGarrity, what do you think about this station?
It's an absolute necessity. It's something that expands and gives us a greater sense of community. It provides tremendous cultural information, social information, political information. And it's really more than local. And I think part of that is based on your efforts, Mary Charlotte, because so many broad-ranging topics are discussed that have an impact on us locally, but really have also a major global influence on our lives. What else can you say about this radio station other than it's a real treasure, and you're part of that?
428-1393 is the number, and we are looking for, yet again, a $1,500 goal today. We're looking for $1,500 by the end of the hour, and it should be quite easy because we're going to give away books by Doug Preston, who wrote this marvelous book called The Monster of Florence. I talked to Doug Preston a few days ago. I actually went to his office. He was just in Santa Fe briefly. And we did an interview on this book called The Monster of Florence. Now, you've read this book,
yeah,
Michael McGarrity.
Yeah.
It's a page-turner.
And, you know, even at the end, you're not really quite sure of who did what to whom.
I know.
There's all these intricacies in terms of how the police operated, how they do the actual case investigation in Italy, and it's so significantly different than our system of justice, which a lot of people now realize because of the Amanda Knox case.
Exactly.
But this book, I think, came out before all of that publicity around Amanda Knox surfaced. And so for me, it was informative and educative, too, because you were looking at a completely different way of operating both the courts and the law enforcement element of the Italian society compared to ours.
And it's amazing to me that the Monster of Florence is, as you will find out, ladies and gentlemen, in just a moment, a serial killer who terrorized Florence for a number of years and has still never been caught. A lot of other people have been caught, put in jail, died in jail, but it turned out that all of them were innocent. And the same prosecutor who was prosecuting the wrong people for the Monster of Florence case prosecuted Amanda Knox.
Yeah, I know. And he's been called up by their version of the judicial standards outfit in Italy for not being very good at his job.
Well, he was actually convicted for abuse of office.
That's right.
And he's still working.
He's still working. Yeah.
So this whole thing is kind of a scandal.
Does it remind you of Jerome Block in any way?
Of who? 428-1393, 428-1393 is the number. Now, you will be able to get, I have 10 signed copies from Doug Preston that he gave me at the end of this interview, 10 hardcover copies, and then we have another 5 paperback copies from the publisher. So let's get the phones ringing, 428-1393, and get a copy of this book. Let's go now to Doug Preston, and Michael McGarrity and I will be back in just a few minutes. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Doug Preston. He's a journalist. He's an author of both fiction and nonfiction books. His latest nonfiction book, published several years ago, is called The Monster of Florence. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, it's good to be here.
So this is a book about a serial killer in Florence, in Italy, whose story you came across when you moved there in around 2000, the year 2000. Who was this guy? What did he? Well, the question of who he was is one of the central questions of your book. But what did he do?
Well, he was Italy's most notorious serial killer. He was sort of the Jack the Ripper of Italy. And he murdered young couples who were making love in their cars in the Florentine Hills, just outside the city. And he was never caught. He killed 11 people. He killed 14 people in the 11-year period from 1974 to 1985. And then he stopped killing. But the investigation was never closed, and it continues today, and it's actually become the longest and most expensive criminal investigation in Italian history.
And the investigation is a very large part of this book, in which you became involved in your own way at a certain point. One of the things that's really stunning about this is how messy and poor and clumsy and just plain incompetent the Italian investigators seem to be. I mean, crime scenes are not closed off. Evidence is uncollected or contaminated. I mean, it's crazy.
Well, it is. The Italians then and now are way behind in terms of forensic science, you know, of evidence collection, DNA. They're just in a very primitive state. Now, they're very good at interrogations. I mean, the way they've broke the mafia were through interrogations and wiretaps and, you know, that kind of police work they're very good at, but the science they're not very good at, and we've seen this in the Amanda Knox case, the same kind of incompetent and even, fraudulent science going on.
So these killings started in, I guess there was a killing in 1968, one in 1974, and then almost every year in the early 80s through 1985.
That's right. It was a very curious case. There was this horrific double murder in 1974 that was never solved. And then there was a gap. And then in 1981, there was a second horrific double murder. And a newspaper reporter noticed that it was quite similar to the murder in 1974. So the police jumped on that. And fortunately, they still had the rounds that had been collected at the crime scene from 1974. They came from a .22 Beretta, and each round had an unmistakable mark on it caused by a defect in the firing pin. So it was, you know, obviously fired from the same gun. And that's when, in 1981, that's when they realized that there was a serial killer on the loose who was murdering young couples. But it got even stranger after another double killing in 1982. The whole city of Florence was in an uproar. The police received an anonymous mail with a clipping in it from the newspaper that was referred back to a 1968 double murder of two people who'd been killed making love in a car. And someone had scribbled on it, "Take another look at this one." So the police did, and again they found, fortunately, that the shells had been preserved, and again they realized that these bullets had been fired from the same gun. But the great mystery of the 1968 killing was that they had solved the case. They had found the killer. He had confessed. He was clearly guilty. This was not a false confession. But he was in prison at the time of the 1974 killing. So they asked him, but both killings were done with the same gun. So they asked this guy, "What did you do with the gun?" And he kept lying about it and lying about it. And this became one of the central mysteries of the case is tracing this gun from hand to hand, because if you find the gun, you find the monster of Florence.
Now, this guy and the gun led to what was called the Sardinian Trail.
That's right. As police reinvestigated the 1968 murder, they realized it was a clan killing, that probably four or five people were involved in murdering this couple. It was a woman who was cheating on her husband, and to preserve the honor of the family, the husband, along with a number of other people, went and murdered the two. And so police investigators said, okay, well, the husband, who confessed and was in prison, didn't do it. So one of these other people who kept the gun went on to become the monster of Florence. He found he enjoyed, forgive the use of that word, this killing so much that he decided to do it again and keep doing it. So he killed a couple in 1974, and then in 1981, to 1985, he went on a killing spree, killing six couples, 12 people.
Always the same pattern. People in the Florentine countryside, not far from Florence, having sex in their cars, young couples.
That's right. The monster had a pattern. It was a ritual, actually. I mean, the psychological profiling of him said that this was a ritualistic sort of thing. He would choose the place, not the victims. He would wait for the car to arrive. He would kill the couple. He would take the woman away from the man, drag her out into the open where he was extremely exposed. He would perform a very hideous ritualistic mutilation on her and take home body parts. And he always left the shells of his .22 Beretta lying on the ground. It was sort of his calling card. But he also mocked the police. He would wait until the police would arrest someone, and everyone, there'd be a big uproar, headlines in the newspapers, and then he would kill again, and the police would be humiliated and have to release that person. And for the last killing, he did something even more horrific. He murdered a couple. It was actually a French couple who were camping in the countryside, killed them, and he mailed a piece of the victim, one of the victims, to the chief prosecutor in the case, who was a woman. And it so freaked her out that she immediately resigned from the case and went everywhere with a police escort, and it pretty much ruined her life.
This case was investigated by both the police in the Polizia in Italy and the Carabinieri, which are kind of another police. Tell us just briefly about these two kind of, I don't know if you would call them competing, but parallel police forces.
Well, they are parallel, and they are very much in competition, and it's one of the problems with Italian criminal investigation. The Polizia are the police, the civilian police, the kind of police we have in this country. The Carabinieri are a branch of the military who also perform a domestic police function. That's their function. And they often, you know, with the scene of the monster crimes, for example, they would arrive at the scene. They'd immediately be in competition trying to get the evidence. You know, the police wanted the evidence. The Carabinieri wanted the evidence. They'd get in arguments. I mean, there have actually been cases where they chase suspects, and, you know, then the police and the Carabinieri would get in a huge fist fight over who was going to take custody of the suspect. So they're in competition with each other. But in the monster case, it became so dramatic. It was such a terrible case, and it became so infamous in Italy that they couldn't solve it, that the police and the Carabinieri came together to form a special squad called the monster squad. Basically, this was a special police unit devoted to nothing but the case.
We're talking to Doug Preston about his book, The Monster of Florence. And I'm here in the Santa Fe Baking Company with Michael McGarrity, and listening to this crazy story, The Monster of Florence.
What can you say? I mean, I've often commented that it's sometimes impossible to figure out what human beings are capable of doing. I mean, I've written 12 mysteries, right? And so I should know something about this, and of course I was a cop too. But what people are capable of doing sometimes is mind-boggling, and truth can often trump fiction in terms of being unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost as if you reach a point where you have to say, I have to suspend belief, because this is just too incredible to be true. But that's not why you brought me here, Mary Charlotte. You brought me here to talk a little bit about public radio in Santa Fe, about this wonderful radio station that you're part of, and you know, I've got to say, the great job that you do. I mean, you're just a Santa Fe treasure.
Thank you. Let me give the telephone number, 428-1393, 428-1393, and if you call that number, you can get a book of The Monster of Florence with Doug Preston. We're going to be giving away this hour, and we've got a total of 15 books, 428-1393. And the hardcovers are signed by Doug Preston, so you might want to pick up one of those, 428-1393. Well, thank you, Michael McGarrity. And you are one of the treasures of Santa Fe, being one of the great mystery writers we have here, and writing about this place. writing about the characters that we have in this state. I mean, I think it must be a great state to write mysteries in.
I think it's a great state for writers of any genre, to be perfectly honest with you, because we have such a rich cultural heritage. We have myth and mystery. We have mayhem and murder. We have, and it goes on and on and on. It's not just in the past. It's also right here and right now. So it's a wonderful landscape to write about, but the people of this state are just incredibly interesting. I was down in Alamogordo, and I was mentioning that I had had breakfast in a little village in the mountains, Mayhill. And I said, everybody in that restaurant looked like they were hiding from something. You know, so people come here to hide, too.
Very interesting. And one would want to live there for a while and slowly befriend these people and find out.
Find out what they're hiding from, what their secrets are. People come here for all sorts of reasons. But what public radio does, it seems to me, is it gives a lot of those characters an opportunity to express themselves. I mean, I'm one of them, right? And you've had me on your show.
You are one of our characters.
One of your characters, right? Just as you are one of the characters in Santa Fe, too. But beyond characters, what public radio does is it gives people a window onto the community that otherwise wouldn't be there. And unfortunately, it's not there as much as it should be in the print media anymore. I am totally troubled by the fact that so many issues in this community don't seem to be very interesting to the people who put out the news anymore, whether it's on the internet or in print. The reporter, I think, does some good investigative reporting, but I really think that the radio station here adds to that with the reporting they do about local issues.
428-1393 is the number. Have you ever, Michael McGarity, thought about doing a true crime book set here in New Mexico?
I don't know whether I would be good at nonfiction. I have given a friend of mine the opportunity to write a true crime book that deals with the absolutely monstrously incompetent murder of Sergeant Joe Harris down in the Hemis Mountains.
Right.
Joe was a friend of mine. His widow Tanya is a friend of mine. We made a presentation last spring or last winter at a conference here about that situation. And I think what's going to happen is Ann Hillerman will be working with Tanya Harris on a true crime book. But that's really not my forte.
Right.
So, but I think Tanya's story about Joe and his wrongful death and his tragic death is a story that needs to be told because it just smacks with incompetence on the part of his department and the officers that put him at risk that led to his death.
428-1393 is the number, and I think we have a report from the control room.
Yes, we have several people to thank. Anonymous, of course.
Yes.
And Carol and Peter Worth.
Thank you.
Shelley Robinson.
Thank you.
Gail Price.
Yay.
Robin Rodar.
Yay.
And we're doing really well. There are people on the phone right now. I'll tell you later about them.
All right.
Put me down for $100.
Michael McGarity.
You got it.
Making a donation right now. Thank you. Thank you so much. We're going to go back now to Doug Preston. Give a call. Get a copy of the Doug Preston book, The Monster of Florence, 428-1393. And if you're calling from out of area and you would like to make a toll-free call, it's 1-866-907-5737. So that's 866-907-KSFR. Let's go back now to Doug Preston.
Now, when you went to Italy in the year 2000, your goal was to write a murder mystery set in Florence about an art historian, a lost Renaissance painting, a murder, and so on. And that project got scrapped when you found out about this story. You met a journalist named Mario Spezzi, who is a central character in this book. Tell us about him.
Well, I moved to Florence. We rented a villa just outside the city, and I was doing research on the novel. And I wanted to find out what happens when the police find a dead body. You know, what do they do in Italy? Because, you know, this The novel opens with the body of this art historian found by the side of the road with his eyes gouged out. You know, this is a thriller, suspense story. And I needed to know how the police operated. Well, so someone said, oh, you've got to talk to Mario Spezzi. He's he knows more about how the police work than the police themselves, because he was the crime reporter for the La Nazione, which is a local newspaper. So we got together, had a bunch of espressos together, and he told me, you know, how the police operate. And in the course of this conversation, I asked him what he'd been working on, and he told me about the Monster of Florence story. And then he asked where I lived, and then the conversation, when he heard where I lived, this very strange smile came on his face, and he said, ah, you live in Giogli, and I know that farmhouse you live in. And he said, yes, it's very interesting, because outside, right outside your door, in the olive grove, was one of the most horrific double homicides in Italian history, done by the Monster of Florence. And then he told me the full story. You know, it was funny. I said, well, the real estate agent didn't tell me that when I rented the house, but I kind of wondered why the house was built like a fortress. But so that's when I first heard the story, and it was completely new. It would never been reported in English. It was a very famous story in Italy, of course, also in Germany and in England to a certain extent, and in France. But there was nothing ever published in America about this story. So I suggested to Mario that we do a newspaper, not a magazine article about it for the New Yorker. I wrote for the New Yorker at the time, and we did. We wrote a piece for the New Yorker, and it was about to be published, and then 9/11 occurred. It was going to be published in late September of 2001, so that piece got bumped. It eventually was published in The Atlantic, but then we decided to do a book about it. So that's where the Monster of Florence came from.
The book exposes so much of the culture and corruption inside the Italian police, the judiciary, and the press itself. Mario Spezzi is an amazing journalist, from the way you describe him, and a real truth seeker, and a real intelligent and, guy who knows how to get the information in the ways that journalists do. And who really cares about getting the truth out there. But a lot of the Italian press, the way even La Nazione, seems to be so much about sensationalism with an utter disregard for what the truth might be.
Yes, you read articles in Italian newspapers and, you know, the most outrageous stuff. They never use the word alleged or, you know, possible. You know, they're not careful. But you know, Italian journalism is not at a good level. But, Spezzi is a wonderful journalist. He's a journalist of the old school, you know, the kind with a cigarette hanging off his lip and 10 espressos a day and wears a trench coat and a fedora. I mean, he really is quite the character, but he is one hell of a journalist. And, you know, as we researched this book, we came up with a lot of very interesting information. And actually, Spezzi had identified a person that he believed was the Monster of Florence. And, you know, we were writing for the New Yorker magazine at the time, and our editor at the New Yorker said, well, when are you going to interview this guy? And I went to Spezzi and said, look, you know, we got to interview this guy. And he said, absolutely not. He said, I am not going to interview this man. I'm terrified of him. You know, I have a wife and a daughter living in the very area where he murdered people. I really don't want to put them in danger. So I called my editor up and I said, well, we don't want to interview him. And she exploded. She was furious. She said, what's the matter with you? She used a lot of four-letter language. She was very tough. She said, we have journalists in war zones getting shot at. And, oh, you're afraid of a little serial killer? Well, I'm so sorry. You're just chicken, you know, whatever. And she went on and on. And so she shamed us into interviewing him. We went to his house at 9:45 at night when we were sure of finding him.
And this was one of the Sardinians.
It was. It was Spezzi found him by tracing the gun. The gun, the same Beretta 22 and the same box of bullets, 50 bullets, were used by the Monster in all of his killings. And then only when he ran out of those 50 bullets, he opened up a new box. But through the entire, from 1968 to 1985, it was the same gun and the same box until 1984, when he ran out and had to open a new box. So Spezzi was able to trace the gun to this person. and who was very much involved in the case at the time. He actually had been arrested as a suspect in the case, and at other times he had been, quote, a police informant, someone who sort of was giving the police information about the case because he was a member of the Sardinian clan. But the most interesting thing, the thing that really pointed to this fellow, was the fact that at a certain point the Italian police were so flummoxed that they contacted the American FBI in secret and asked for the behavioral science unit, you know, that unit made so famous by Thomas Harris and The Silence of the Lambs, asked that group to prepare a psychological profile of the monster of Florence, which they did. The profile did not at all fit the Italian police's preconceptions about who this monster was, so they suppressed it. And nobody knew that this report existed until Spezzi dug it out somewhere. And it is absolutely incredible. It describes perfectly this individual.
Whom you interviewed.
Who we interviewed. And it's so uncanny. I mean, and also the specificity of the report is really startling.
Now, they didn't know about any of the suspects. They just knew the nature of the crimes and then made a psychological profile of the killer based on that evidence.
That's right. Basically, they had a database of serial killers. And they found that serial killers fall into certain types. And the Monster of Florence was a type. It was a psychosexual killer who killed for libidinous, you know, really sick libidinous purposes, who mutilated his victims, took home, you know, pieces of them. And this report said that there are quite a few serial killers who do this in the world, in history. And these are the characteristics that this serial killer is likely to have. And it went through everything. I mean, his level of education, his modus operandi, his whether he had a car or not, all these things.
Whether he lived with an old aunt.
Yes, whether he was married or not. And, you know, the report, you know, indicated that this type of serial killer has a deep misogynist, but at the same time he needs women. And is sexually impotent. He can't have them in the normal way. And so the only way he can possess them is to kill them and you know, take away parts of their bodies. I mean, it really is strong stuff, I'm afraid. But
and it's so hard. I mean, I'm reading this book, and it feels like I'm reading a made-up thriller. And the fact that it's the truth is very disturbing.
Well, the book, in the largest sense, is an exploration of evil, of human evil. Evil is one of the most inexplicable and mysterious things that that human beings encounter. You know, you look at a Hitler, you look at, you know, the great evil of wars and the things that people have done, and it's very mysterious. And the Monster of Florence was pure evil. And so the book is really, in its largest sense, an exploration of this evil and an attempt to understand, at least in a small way, what this evil is and, you know, where it came from and so forth. But then there are many layers of evil in the book. I mean, the problem with the investigation was that at a certain point it was no longer a search for the truth, but it was a desperate attempt to just, you know, find a solution, whatever solution. Convict anybody. Let's just get this case done.
I mean, and justify your theories along the way, even when evidence to the contrary comes up.
Exactly. So the idea was, you know, the police were humiliated. It was a national humiliation for the country of Italy that they couldn't solve this crime. And so the pressure was so intense to solve it that they just started arresting innocent people. Many, many innocent lives ruined. There were suicides. People went mad. There were, you know, crazy seances and in graveyards and all kinds of crazy things happened. Clairvoyants were enlisted by the police. They were so desperate, and they realized, on the one hand, if they didn't solve the case, their careers were finished. But if they did, quote, solve the case, it would be a stepping stone to great career advancement. And that's what it became. Was for a certain number of police investigators, it became a way to to advance their careers. And they did eventually arrest a perfectly innocent man. He was a horrible monster, but he wasn't the monster. Convicted him, and those people involved in that conviction went on to great glory and were promoted. And then when the man was in his appeals trial, he was found to be innocent and then acquitted. But they had already advanced their careers, and you know, they had accomplished what they were interested in. So there's a lot of, you know, careerism and...
Which, as you say, is its own kind of evil. I mean, there's the evil of these killings, which is brutal beyond imagination. And then there's also this total inability to bring the right people to justice, the ruining of many lives along the way, and the advancement of careers without getting to any kind of truth.
Yes, I mean, there were you know, police involved, investigators involved who really wanted to find the truth and were seeking the truth. But there were an awful lot of powerful people who were looking on this as a wonderful opportunity to advance their careers. And one of them went on to become the head of the anti-mafia unit in Italy, which is the most powerful police position in the country. Another one went on to become the liaison between the FBI, the American FBI, and the Italian police, which was another extremely plum job. And, you know, on the backs of the convictions of innocent people. And, you know, there were a number of other people who were convicted who died in prison who were clearly innocent. But the investigation was never closed because these investigators got off on a wrong tangent at a certain point and said, oh, this wasn't a lone serial killer. This was a satanic sect.
Which was completely made up. It was just fabricated.
It came out of thin air. It was crazy. It was this crazy theory. But the problem was that from the very beginning, there was all these rumors about Satanism, that there was something, you know, that Satanists must be involved in this. I mean, this
just because it's so evil and this is a country that believes in the devil.
Exactly. It's a very Italian thing. Italians like to believe that, even intelligent, you know, educated Italians talk about how the Satanism is rampant in their country and their satanic sects and so forth. But it's really, the evidence doesn't bear it out. There are, you know, a few crazy people who kill cats and do things like that, but the idea was that this was a satanic sect dating back to the Middle Ages that was populated, or that was, the members were nobility and doctors and lawyers and people highly placed in Florentine society who they needed body parts for their black masses, and the body parts became the blasphemous wafer for use in these black masses. I mean, to Americans, that sounds crazy, but the Italians took this very seriously. They went back through the mountain of evidence involved, and they found, you know, what they thought were clues pointing to Satanism. And even though the really poor forensic work that had been done, but the forensic work showed that this was the work of a lone serial killer, a right-handed tall man. No one else was involved, but the Italians just loved this theory of Satanism, and this became this enormous investigation, which is still going on. It's still open, and they're still looking for the members of the satanic sect.
We're talking to Doug Preston. And once again, I am in the Santa Fe Baking Company with Michael McGarrity, the great mystery writer, talking about another great mystery writer, namely Doug Preston. And what a book!
Well, for about the last third of this section of your interview, Doug was talking very eloquently about evil.
Which is one of your topics.
One of my topics. But as he was talking, I was thinking to myself, what I should really say to the audience is, yes, there's evil in the world, but there's also good in the world. And a good thing to do right now would be to pick up the phone and make a donation to KSFR Radio so that they can continue their good works, because good will trump evil more often than not, and this would be a wonderful thing to do. Why? Because they have great jazz, which I love. They have Diego Mulligan, which is a fine, fine drive-home show.
The Journey Home from 5 to 6.
The Amy Goodman. All of these things contribute to the community, and they do good. So, listeners out there, you can do good. You can support Mary Charlotte and make a donation, support KSFR, make a donation, pick up the phone, do it now.
428-1393 is the number. We are more than halfway to our goal. We're doing very well. Give a call. Let's get all the books out the door to you, the Doug Preston books, The Monster of Florence, 428-1393. And I hear the heavy breathing of Marilyn LeBlanc.
Oh, boy. Oh, lots of thanks, Roberto Capocchi.
Thank you.
And Jim Smith.
Thank you.
Karen Walker, I don't know if it's Karen Walker Real Estate, or she's a realtor anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And she wants to mention that you, Mary Charlotte, have tremendous marketing skills and efforts. And she's also requesting some cookies.
Oh, cookies.
Yes.
I sent out an email and I said, I'm going to get myself into trouble now, but I said, I'm going to make chocolate chip cookies this weekend. So if anybody who donates wants some cookies, they should write to me at radiocafe@ksfr.org and I will give them some cookies.
And a few more, well, two more people, Margaret Card and
thank you.
Randy Bennett from Desert Academy says,
yay,
say hi to you.
You.
Thank you. Here you go.
Wonderful. Thanks. And keep those phones ringing, 428-1393. We want to get to, and in fact, past our goal of $1,500 for this hour. I think we can do it. I think we're well on the way. So give a call to 428-1393. And Michael McGarrity, truly, I mean, you have been a cop and you have seen the workings of evil. You have written about it in great detail. You think good trumps evil?
It darn well better. Otherwise, we're in big trouble. But sometimes when I look at what's happening in the world in terms of how dysfunctional society has become, not just here in this country, but it seems like almost globally, I'm wondering whether we have the social backbone to survive as a people who really care about others and want to do the right thing. Do we have social responsibilities? Do we have civic responsibilities? Or is it all about the money? Is it all about I get mine, I don't care about yours? So I hope that good trumps evil, but I'm afraid we're in a period where things are deteriorating in terms of our social structures and our social institutions, and that's very scary.
That is very scary. What does that look like to you? What does that social crumbling look like?
It looks like what I'm most afraid of is this whole true believer mentality that's out there, which is, I don't know, Eric Hoffer wrote the book, The True Believer, and it's really a classic. It came out 50-some years ago, I think. But The True Believer is really very scary because they hold on to their beliefs regardless of any kind of rational or secular or scientific information to the contrary. So we have people out there who are running for president who don't believe in climate change.
Right.
I mean, is that scary or is that scary?
That's very, very scary.
So it's the true believers of the world, regardless of where they are on the political spectrum, that can be really quite destructive in terms of weakening the social fabric.
428-1393. If you believe in the social fabric and people basically sticking together in community, that is what KSFR is all about. We are about building community, and we are about maintaining that community through letting you, our listeners, get to know each other. This is the way that you get to know Michael McGarrity. This is the way that you get to know Doug Preston. And these are people who are part of our community. 428-1393, we want the phones to ring. We want to give away every last copy of The Monster of Florence. And I have to say, when I was reading this book, I was reading it over the last few weeks and had basically maybe two or three nights reading this book, and I would go to bed, have this book, and I was so tired that I would fall asleep and I would wake myself up so that I could keep reading it because it was so good.
It was good.
I didn't even want to sleep, even though, you know, that doesn't happen very often. I read a lot of books, but it's not like that.
Doug wrote a very good book. As a matter of fact, a lot of people don't realize that He's as gifted at writing nonfiction as he is fiction. And for people who haven't read his first book, Cities of Gold, I would really recommend it. It's a lovely, lovely book, and very informative and very engaging. It reads like fiction, but it's not. And Doug's a great guy, and his contribution to the community is really wonderful. And all of you people, get yourself a signed copy of Doug's hardback. It's a first edition signed copy. Those things are investments. You know, let's talk about the fact that if you have a love of books and you have a first edition signed copy from a world-renowned national New York Times bestseller, you've got yourself a little choice thing there. It's an investment opportunity.
It's
get
true.
That book.
Get that book. And I have to also say, the publisher is sending us 5 more books, which I believe are the paperback. But the great thing about the paperback, so you can't go wrong either way, is that it has the new afterword, which contains information about Amanda Knox.
Ah, good.
And who was acquitted like a day or two after he and I did that interview, so
right.
We weren't sure what was going to happen. 428-1393 is the number. Let's go back to Doug Preston.
So getting back to the suspect whom you and the journalist Mario Spezzi interviewed, what was he like? We've been talking about evil. Did you get that sense, that aura of evil from this man?
Well, it was a big surprise. I had a lot of preconceptions. I've never met a serial killer, but, you know, you see them on TV.
And you're a thriller writer.
And
so.
I'm a thriller writer. So I had all these preconceptions about what he'd be like. Creepy, weird, strange, you know. Well, he wasn't like that at all. He welcomed us. He was definitely weird, but he had a tremendous charisma about him. He was very good looking, very handsome. He welcomed, we buzzed his apartment, you know, without any kind of invitation. We didn't call ahead of time. We didn't want to warn him who we were. And Mario Spezzi was so nervous that he used a fake name, a Marco Tiezzi or something like that, similar
to Spezzi.
It sounded
like, yeah.
So he buzzed us up. We walked in. He's wearing his underwear. He had a very muscular body covered with tattoos, and he had some scars that looked like knife scars on his body. But he was very charming and smiling in a rough kind of working class way. He reminded me of Robert De Niro. He projected a lot of charisma. But the first thing that happened was he looked at Spezzi and he said, "Oh, wait, you're Mario Spezzi. You're the guy who wrote all those articles on the monster case. I've wanted to meet you for the longest time." He said, "I must have misheard your name." You know, Spezzi turned white. And then we told this gentleman that, you know, I was a reporter for The New Yorker and that Spezzi was just helping me out with the case. And could we ask him a few routine questions? "Yes, of course. Come in, please. Sit down. Have a little glass of Mirtillo, which is a Sardinian liqueur, which we had a little glass of." Then Spezzi took out his tape recorder and said, "Can I tape this?" And he said, no, my voice is far too lovely to be trapped in that little box." You know, so Spezzi had to put his tape recorder away, but he did take copious notes. So we started asking him questions about the case, very gentle, kind of broad questions at first, and he was astonishingly knowledgeable about it. It was amazing. He knew everything about the case. And then the questions became more pointed. And then Spezzi started referring to things that had never been published, certain details about the crimes, especially about the knife that was used and things like this that were in the medical examiner's report that the newspapers never published because they were too awful.
Yeah, it was supposed to be a scuba knife.
Yes, and well, this guy revealed information about the case that we don't believe had ever been made public. He knew things that had never been made public. And then at a certain point, the medical examiner had said that the incisions, the mutilations, had probably been done with a knife like a scuba knife, a certain, you know, style of knife that had notches and serrations in it, just like a scuba knife. At a certain point, this fellow was describing to us how he'd had a fight with his father, and he said, "I held my scuba knife up to his throat. You know, I carried a scuba knife with me everywhere." And it almost seemed like a challenge to us. But he never stopped smiling, even when the questions became so pointed that it was obvious that we thought he was the monster of Florence. And he never stopped smiling. And finally, Mario came out and asked him point blank, "Are you the monster of Florence?" And his answer is unfortunately not repeatable on the radio, but it was awful. It was a no, but it was a very disgusting no.
You, having looked at this case, you and Spezzi, and having come to this interview, do you think that he is the killer?
I believe the evidence does point to him, especially the evidence of the gun. I mean, it's all circumstantial evidence, and in this case, one has to be very careful with circumstantial evidence. I mean, an awful lot of innocent people have had their lives ruined because of, you know, being accused of being the monster of Florence. But in this case, you know, the psychological profile that was done, the circumstantial evidence, tracing the gun, everything indicates that this fellow is a very likely suspect.
And yet, the police and, well, one thing that was interesting was there was this police investigation, as we talked about before, a Carabinieri investigation. The Carabinieri were interested in the Sardinian connection. The police scoffed at that. There was kind of a battle. The police won. The Sardinian trail investigation was closed. And with all this evidence, which you have in your book, I mean, I'm reading it, and I'm following it, and I'm convinced, the police don't even look at this guy, and one wonders, is he their friend? Is this suspect being protected by them in some way?
Well, he's being protected not as a friend, and there's no police involvement in the murders themselves, which someone might think. But what it really was is protecting their reputations. It's saving face. I mean, the police are on this crazy wild goose chase after a satanic sect, and they've been doing that for 10 years, over 10 years. They can't go back and admit they were wrong without a huge loss of face. What happened in the case was that the Carabinieri and the Polizia disagreed about the case, and there was a huge split, although it was kept under wraps. It wasn't reported at the time. And the Carabinieri withdrew from the case completely. But a small group of completely obsessed high Carabinieri officials continued to investigate illegally. And they identified the same person that we found as their suspect. They believe that he is the monster of Florence. But unfortunately, they really can't do anything because the police are completely in charge of the official investigation, and the Carabinieri really don't want to get back involved. In fact, a very high official in the Carabinieri told Mario Spezzi, said, if the monster Florence knocked on my door and wanted to confess, I would say to him, sorry, I don't want to talk to you, go to the police.
And that is the end of our interview as far as we've gotten with Doug Preston. I actually did a little bit more, actually another 15 or so minutes, and we'll be airing the whole thing at some future date so that you can hear it. But right now, the number is 428-1393. We've got two books left, two copies of The Monster of Florence, and we have $300 or so to go to our $1,500 goal. So give a call, 428-1393. We've got some thank yous.
Right. Beverly Singer.
Thank you.
Diane Ishman.
Yay.
Roberta.
Yay.
Jacqueline Nielsen.
Thank you.
Deborah Bolt.
And
excellent. Pamela Edel.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to all of those people. If you love Morning Cafe, if you love Mary Charlotte, and how can you not love Mary Charlotte, pick up the phone. Let's get the $1,500 done before we have to go off the air. All those writers out there that live in Santa Fe, come on, guys. I know we're not really a community of kindred souls, and we all work in solitary confinement as we do our writing. But you listen to the radio, you listen to Mary Charlotte. She's interviewed you time and again, promoting your books, promoting your work. Pick up the phone. Let's get over the $1,500 barrier before we go off the air. This radio station serves a wonderful purpose in this community, and we are very lucky to have it and have all those volunteers that put in hours and hours and hours of their time to give us great programming, great news, great music, great public events. So call now. Mary Charlotte, what's the number again?
It's 428-1393, 428-1393, and the toll-free number is 866-907-1393. 5737. That's 866-907-KSFR. And let's get down to zero books left, because I don't want to be embarrassed before Doug or anybody else. 428-1393. Let's give away all 15 books. So, Michael McGarrity, you've been writing for how many decades?
About three, but I've only been published for the last, 15 years?
Is that right?
Yeah.
So it's not like you were at this when you were 20 years old.
No, not at all.
Did you know you were going to be a writer?
My sweetie says that I did, but I had, probably bragged at some point in my early years that I was going to someday be a writer. But no, I took off and had a 25-year career in criminal justice before I actually sat down and tried to start writing my first book.
Which gave you the ability to write all the books that you have written.
Gave me a lot of practical experience, absolutely.
428-1393. It's just a delight to be with you, Michael McGarrity.
We've
talked
my
about you've been writing about a book a year, and I think we've talked about every book that's come out since I started doing this show 8 years ago, or pretty close to it.
It was a book a year up until about 3 years ago, when I spread my wings and said I'm going to stop writing the series for a while and write a prequel, a historical epic novel prequel to the series. And so that book is done. It'll be out next spring in May before Father's Day. And I've got a contract for two more, so it's going to be a trilogy.
A trilogy. I'm so excited about this. 428-1393. We're going to have you back. I demand to be your first interview.
Of course. You win. I wouldn't have it any other way.
Michael McGarrity, it's just great to have you on. And ladies and gentlemen, let's get to that $1,500 goal. Mary Lynn LeBlanc, is the phone ringing? Oh, we'll find out in just a moment. 428-1393. Yes?
Yeah, it's ringing, and it's a little hard to kind of keep up with the information coming out. And I think I've mispronounced somebody's name, but haven't been able to get whose name that was.
Oh, sorry.
Lisa Freeman.
Thank you.
For sure. And Loey, I'm not sure about this last
name. Loey Fecteau.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And Anne.
I think it might have been Pamela Epple.
That was it, probably. Okay, and Anne, too.
And Anne.
Yes.
Thanks to all of you. We're going to have to go in just less than a minute. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. If you write to me, you can be on the KSFR Radio Cafe mailing list, and a few times a year,